Welcome to Turning Point, a podcast dedicated to sharing the always inspiring, sometimes heartbreaking stories of people working in the social services profession. We'll be hearing stories of triumph over incredible odds, as well as the setbacks and challenges that people face along the way. We'll hear from people working in addiction and mental health, residential treatment programs, and community-based services, as well as some of the clients that those people serve. We'll be focusing on how to increase your impact as a professional and the role of helping people overcome their own challenges through stories of impactful moments, both in treatment and in life. We'll hear tips, tools, strategies, and resources that you can apply to your own practice starting today. Turning Point is brought to you by Enviros, a diverse social services organization dedicated to strengthening youth and families in Alberta through a unique and powerful combination of experiential, strengths-focused, family-centered programming. You can learn more at www.enviros.org. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Coulard.
When I started ice climbing, it was the first day that I went ice climbing was the first time that I ever felt freedom from this emotional burden that I had lived with my entire life.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Turning Point. Today's guest is Margot Talbot, a renowned climber, writer, and speaker based out of Canmore, Alberta. Margot's is an inspiring story of overcoming addiction and suicidal depression through what was essentially a journey into adventure and wilderness therapy. Margot's got a unique and powerful view of the mental health and addiction field, having been a client in it for a significant portion of her life. In this interview, we cover a wide range of topics and ideas, and I hope that you enjoy it as much as I did. Here's Margot.
When somebody asks you what you do, how do you answer that? You're into lots of different things. What are you into?
Yeah, well, the first thing I usually talk about is my speaking and my writing. And the last thing I used to talk about is my climbing, which is kind of the reverse of what I used to do. The speaking and the writing has just become really important for me because I feel that the message is such a necessary one in our society today about mental health and addiction issues.
Cool. Well, let's dive into that. What is your message? What is the message that you want to get to professionals primarily? Because that's probably who's listening to this podcast, but anybody who's got an interest in addiction, mental health, and healing.
What I really want to get across is that there's alternatives to the model that was available when I was going through my healing journey, i.e. wilderness therapy is becoming more and more well-known and grounded in that type of service. And just the fact that every person heals differently and has different manifestations of trauma or whatever their life event was that led them to down the road of addiction. And basically just the message that you have the capacity inside of you to heal yourself. You need lots of help and support from the outside to be sure, but there isn't just one right way to do it. And I'll use as my best example the AA model or the NA model, the 12-step model. It works brilliantly for some people, and it doesn't work at all for others.
If you don't mind, let's dive in a little bit to your journey and what you found most powerful and some of those turning points in your journey, because you've battled with addiction and mental health in the past and healed through a journey of ice climbing, which is really, I think, what drives now, like you say, your speaking and your writing and your engagement with people going through that process. But what was it like being in that process and being inside of that system that wasn't helping, that wasn't helpful for you?
I think the biggest thing that wasn't helpful was dealing with a number of mental health professionals that had never lived through what I had lived through. So they had studied books and they had theories and they could give me some gems or they could give me some direction and signposts, but for the most part, the people who helped me the most were the people that understood trauma from the inside and understood basically childhood neglect and abuse from the inside.
When did the journey turn for you? Like, can you identify kind of a point in time when things started to shift? And when, I know you speak of your kind of first experience ice climbing, if you wouldn't mind kind of describing what happened and why it was powerful and what happened after that.
Yeah, as is with life, there's certain synchronicities that we can't really explain, but I actually got thrown in jail for drug dealing within a month of being introduced to ice climbing. And those two events in combination would alter the course of my life. I never wanted to end up in jail again and lose control over my life in that way. And when I started ice climbing, it was the the first day that I went ice climbing was the first time that I ever felt freedom from this emotional burden that I had lived with my entire life. And I had thought it was just my birthright. I thought it was just the way I was. I didn't have an understanding back then of the driving forces for my mental illness or my addiction, which was childhood trauma. So the first day that I went ice climbing, I felt joy. I felt light. I instantly realized that this was how most people lived their everyday life. And I knew on that day that I was going to be able to bring that feeling more and more into my life. It was just going to be a matter of time. And knowing that, I also knew that I was going to be able to let go of the drugs. Because drug addiction is not about doing drugs and getting high. It's about escaping from your pain. And so if I could work on that pain and lessen that pain, I knew that I could get off my dependency on external substances like drugs and alcohol.
Cool. So that certainly sounds like a turning point for you, that first, those two kind of experiences, very polar opposite experiences of going to jail and ice climbing within a short period of time. Anything else that stands out for you that people you met on the journey or other experiences that you had? I mean, we'll talk a bit about your book, obviously, in a bit, but other kind of important milestones that you would say in your journey that stand out for you?
Yeah, meeting what was to become my main climbing partner and best friend, Karen McNeil, when I was 33 years old. So I was off drugs at this point, but still very suicidally depressed. And shortly after meeting Karen, she helped me find my key therapist, which was a woman named Elaine in the Mental Health Services of Alberta. Now, the key feature of these people, I realize in retrospect, was the same key feature that I got from ice climbing, which was presence. When I ice climbed, I came into the present moment. And Karen and Elaine were both incredibly present for me on my journey. And I think that's another piece when you say what didn't work for you through when I was going through the social services system or going to see several therapists, psychologists, counselors. Having somebody be there, right there with you instead of writing notes in a book or, thinking about who they were going to refer you to or what pharmaceutical drug they were going to put you on, just people who sat and listened to your story. And I think that this is a cultural thing, Jeff. I think that there's a lot of people in our society that aren't present, not by any fault of their own, but simply because our society is one of many distractions and it's speedy and very fast. And I think that a lot of the times we mistake cleverness or knowledge, like book-based knowledge, for actual, we mistake it for the deeper wisdom that goes back through millennia of just hearing people's stories and being there for them and being empathetic and compassionate.
Yeah, and to some respect, I think acknowledging that we're all on our own journey and all of us are on a spectrum of addiction and mental health. I think looking into society and then looking, like you say, we live in a distracted world, and that's really the roots causes of mental health and addiction is not being able to be present, not happy and satisfied with whatever's happening in the present moment, perseverating on the past or anxious about the future and using addiction, like you say, to cope with pain. I don't think that, we prescribe it to the hardcore addicts or the people that we perceive as the hardcore addicts who are, using drugs on the street. We don't necessarily take that same lens and look at how we are eating habits and our, internet usage and watching TV and all the other things that we do to distract ourselves from the present moment. And so one of the things that Enviros that we talk a lot about with staff and we're all kind of working on is this idea of a shared journey or a parallel process that we as professionals have our own healing and growth to do, just like any other person that we're working with. What are your thoughts on that, this idea of professionals being on a shared journey, because it changes the role, I think, of professionals from helpers and fixers and people who have the answers to people who are also on a journey, also maybe just don't have the answers, but are there to facilitate and to, like you say, listen empathetically. Yeah, I'm curious about what your thoughts are on that.
Well, you're touching on two things that are deep beliefs of mine. And one is that it's a spectrum. A suicidally depressed person is just infinitely more unhappy than someone who's living through the regular ups and downs of life. So to that end, absolutely, the workers, helpers, counselors, whatever we name we use for them, are on a journey. And I think that's one of the powers of Enviros, because it touches on the second point, which is the hierarchy. We live in a hierarchical society that separates us from each other. And the classical walking into a psychiatrist or psychologist's office, there's an immediate hierarchy of, I'm the professional, I know how to fix you, you're the screwed up client. Maybe they wouldn't use those words, but I'll just use those. That's how I felt walking into the office, is I'll own that myself. All of a sudden, it becomes more of a partnership. Let's work through this together. I understand you because I'm human as well, and I suffer from the same things. They just might not be as extreme. Now, I happen to know that one of the problems we encounter, at least I did in the social services system, is that this hierarchy is kept in place for various reasons, like a professional detachment, they would call it. And I understand why they have that written into their code of ethics or code of conduct, but I don't think it's serving, because it inhibits the connection that the traumatized person needs so badly, whereas the Enviros model encourages the connection that the client needs so badly.
Yeah, it's an interesting line to walk, I think, and we're kind of constantly evaluating it. It's, I think, like you say, in school, and you can read books and you can become an expert, and things can get pretty black and white pretty fast. And Enviros, we always talk about living in the gray, and it's in the gray with every client, not just kind of, programs live a little bit in the gray, but each client is unique. Each client has different needs and is going to connect differently with staff and programs. And so it's a very flexible and moving line sometimes.
And that's why I like to use the word gestalt when I think of Enviros, because that's how I think of my own healing journey. I took what resonated with me. I took what I felt was going to work for me, and I kind of made my own pot of healing modalities. And I feel like Enviros does the same. It uses adventure therapy, to be sure, but it also uses every other sort of healing modality. And it's, Enviros is very open to those things. There's no categorical, oh, no, we don't go there. Mm-hmm. There may be a no after an exploration period, but I find that it's very open-minded to allowing the client at the same time as guiding, shaping, and putting out signposts for the client.
Let's talk about your book, All the Glitters, you wrote a few years ago. And I'm curious about what motivated you to write your story down and share it with the world. Was there kind of a point in time where you said, this needs to be shared, or did you write it for yourself and then it got published, or what was that process like?
Well, that's a good question, because I intended to take my secrets to the grave with me. I had created this post-depression, post-drug addiction life for myself, and very few people knew about my past, even people I had known for decades. So the real thrust for writing down my story was feeling like I couldn't go to my grave without sharing what I had learned. And at the time, I had no idea how many people were suffering from mental illness, because I kept it a secret and didn't really talk about it or look it up or anything. I had no idea how many people were suffering from the same things as I was. But the main thrust was, I wrote the kind of book that I would have liked to find in the middle of my own suicidal depression. I wrote the book that I thought, if it only gives one person hope, one little Margot or one little Michael, hope for their future, then it was worth bearing my secrets to the world, and it was worth all the work and heartache that it was going to take to bring this book to publication. Now, I have to say, a lot of things happened for me that I didn't realize were going to happen. For one thing, I was very worried about being judged for my past, and I have gotten nothing but compassion and acceptance for my past and who I am and who I've become, and I did not see that coming.
And what was the process like when you actually sat down to write? Did you find, were you surprised at all by that process of writing your story, or was that as important a part of the healing journey as ice climbing?
I thought it was going to be easy for me. I went to therapy for 20 years. You have psychologists and psychiatrists and social workers probing your mind. I thought it was just going to be a matter of, okay, I put it together in a readable story and it's done. What actually happened was really different, Jeff. I felt like it was another layer of healing for me to be 47, which is when I wrote the book, to be 47 and going back in time, not just through the therapy, but back to the childhood, back to the formative events, back to the addictions and the years of what I'll call oblivion seeking. It was interesting to go back, and sometimes I had to actually take a break from writing the book because I would literally go back and be in that mental state that I was in, which was really hard when it comes to the suicidal depression pieces. So it was another layer of healing. It was nothing but a positive experience in the end. And I have to admit that the only way I was able to keep going writing this book was to tell myself that I never had to publish it. If in the end I decided I couldn't publish it, I was just going to shelve the book and it was going to be just for me.
Certainly glad that you published it. Obviously it's become a must read book for Enviro staff for sure. Speaking of Enviro staff, because part of this podcast is, to be totally frank and honest, is just interesting stuff for Enviro staff to reflect on. And a lot of Enviro staff are young professionals, kind of first coming into the field of helping profession. What advice would you give them right off the bat that you think is going to help set them up for success with their clients and personally and professionally?
Well, the first thing I'm going to say is I'm going to harken back to something you said earlier. Healing yourself is the best thing you can do if you want to help heal others. It's you first. Secondly, develop presence in your own life, because that's the greatest quality that you can have as a counselor or as a healer. Which basically Enviro staff are healers. They are helping people on their healing journey. Other things I would recommend, trust yourself the same way that I had to trust what would work for me and what wouldn't and what I was going to allow in and not allow in. To trust yourself to know in any given moment, and that ties in with presence. That the more present a person becomes, the more you can act off the cuff or shoot from the hip, because you have that fundamental gut feeling or gut instinct on how to navigate situations. Because let's face it, in the work that the Enviro's staff does, there's a lot of unknowns, you know, curveballs and sideswipes that come your way simply by working with that demographic. And it takes a necessary skill set, but it also pushes the staff in ways that most people don't get pushed in their everyday life, and they certainly don't get pushed to that degree in their profession.
Yeah, for sure. That's great advice. And I'm curious about presence. How do you cultivate presence? What have you picked up along your journey that really you find kind of the most helpful ways for you to be present?
Yeah, well, I'll just briefly go into the past. So we've talked about how climbing created presence in my life. I meditated a lot in my mid to late 30s, so during my suicidal periods, as well as when I came out of them. Just meditated a lot to get a hold of my energetic system, because when you grow up in very emotionally stressful and chaotic environments, you tend to recreate those unconsciously. So getting a hold and a grasp on those bigger things. But so now I don't meditate anymore, although I do still recommend it as a modality. I don't meditate anymore. I have a skill level. My skill level comes in and on an everyday basis, so I consider life to be my meditation now. So for instance, when I get triggered, anger is my primary emotion that comes out when I get triggered. When I get triggered, I now know to stop and have a look as the emotion arises instead of reacting instantaneously to that emotion. So to me, that's the meditation of life, of being able to stop yourself and say, am I just having a reaction to something, or am I actually choosing how I'm going to respond to something? Another way that I cultivate presence is when I catch my mind ruminating over things, whether it's something that happened in the past that I can't change, or there's an upcoming meeting and I'm worried about, or I'm just stressed the way anybody would be for like a job interview or something like that. I need to catch myself and bring myself into the moment and remind myself of all of the skills and experience that will help me navigate the meeting to the best of my ability.
Well, that's great advice. It's interesting. We've been studying, actually, doing some research on both Camp and Shunda Creek on this idea of mindfulness, and which, you know, is our language for presence. And at Shunda Creek, they're really showing that the two traits of mindfulness, non-reactivity and non-judgment, are actually driving treatment outcomes. So when clients develop better abilities to not react to stimulus, like triggers, like you say, and not judge their thoughts and feelings and reactions to things, their treatment outcomes improve pretty dramatically. And we're starting to link those two together, which is very interesting. And I think that, you know, it's great advice for professionals, for us to hone those skills, but it's also the exact skills that our clients need to hone as well. So it goes back to that shared journey, that parallel process. We can all work on the same things together.
Yeah, and this the idea of holding space for someone, which is what Karen and Elaine did for me, before someone is able to hold their own space, the staff at Enviros can hold space for them. And that's why it's so important that they clear out their own emotional debris and become present themselves. And I'm not talking about perfection here. I'm talking about that learning journey that's going to last a lifetime, let's face it, in a good way, in an exciting way. So holding space for the client, when a client is around someone for the very first time who's truly listening and truly present for them, they will never forget that experience. That is like the most potent drug in the universe, because that's what we all want at the bottom of it all. We want validation. And the person who's trying to escape from childhood pain is trying to escape from some sort of neglect or abuse where they didn't feel validated. And so I know there's lots of different words like mindfulness or even for me to say holding space. I think it's really important to bring lofty ideas down to the concrete level. Mm-hmm. So for me, that's why I give the examples of, say, mountain sports, where I have to focus, because if I was to try to describe to a traumatized 22-year-old what presence was, they truly may not even understand what I'm talking about. But if I can give a concrete example of stare at the tree, and every time a thought comes into your mind, just ignore it and keep staring at the bark on the tree, that's a concrete way to explain presence to them.
Yeah, and that's, I think, really the foundations of Enviros. You know, goes back, we're celebrating our 40th anniversary this year, and 40 years ago, there's a recognition that you can do things differently in the wilderness, and you can do things differently through an experiential or adventure model. The conversation about risk and trust and communication and whatever it is they're working on from a skills perspective, you know, is very different at the top of a telephone pole or the top of a mountain than it is sitting in the counselor's office on a couch for an hour. So I think that by its very nature, a lot of the work that we do is designed to cultivate that sense of presence. And when we can do it even more intentionally, you know, so much the better.
You know, and what you're saying, if I could paraphrase what you're saying to my own belief system, we learn through our bodies, and presence comes to us through our bodies. It's not a fluke that I became present when I was ice climbing, because presence is an embodied state. It's not just in your mind. It's so engaging the body into that presence is of crucial importance. And that's something that Enviros understands that a lot of mental health service professionals don't understand yet. But I'm seeing it gain more and more traction, this idea of doing exercise, lowering stress levels, and using it as mindfulness exercises, etc.
Yeah, it's interesting to watch. It's kind of going from adjunct, you know, those things. It's like, yeah, go to your cognitive behavioral therapy session, but then go do some yoga, to, you know, yoga actually being core, or exercise, like you say, or, you know, these somatic experiences becoming therapy. It's been interesting to watch that evolution. I mean, still, like you say, a long way to go. I think that the sector at large relies very heavily on rational, conversational types of therapies that may or may not be very, very, very effective.
Yes. And there's something I want to say, because I don't want to forget before the end of the phone call, that relates to this.
Sure.
With I when I did a talk for Enviro's staff in Calgary a few years back, I had a staff ask me, you know, how can I have a higher success rate? How can I get these kids off drugs and keep them off drugs? And what I would like to say to Enviro's staff is, you're helping everyone you touch, whether they stay off drugs or not. And what I mean by that is you're giving them fundamental life skills, and you're giving them a worldview of their situation that they didn't have when they came in, because they were inside the bottle and you can't see the label from inside the bottle, so to speak. And that when they leave, you've planted so many seeds and you've given them so many life skills that when they leave, even if they have a relapse, and even if they maybe they stay on a lower grade drug for years before they get off of it, the help that you've given them, the presence that you've given them, and the skills that you've given them never go away. So I see a success rate as being far more than did they stay off drugs for X number of months or years after they left the program. And I'm not saying that that's not the ideal. Of course, it is the ideal. What I am saying is that to never feel like you didn't have an impact, and to not necessarily judge it by a statistic called how many people stayed off drugs for the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, we're working at that, I think, actively as an agency to redefine success, because oftentimes in the sector, you know, I was at a workshop the other day with 7 or 8 different addictions providers, and we were all giving overviews of our services. Still, the prevailing conversation is completion rates. Did somebody actually finish the program? And I'm like, that's the worst success metric in the world. Like, who cares? Did something shift for them? Did something change for them? Are they living a more positive life? Are they meeting their goals? You know, those are the kinds of things we need to measure, and they're hard to measure sometimes, and they're a bit messier to measure. But we're certainly trying to do that at Enviros anyway, because whether a kid stays at camp for 70 days or 90 days doesn't really, at the end of the day, matter much. Like you say, it matters where the seeds planted, and do those seeds start to blossom at some point in their life?
Absolutely. Because I know for myself, and I'm going to come back to that word gestalt, because it is the best word to use. For me, it was a gestalt, and it was almost like the 100th monkey descended upon me when I got thrown in jail at the same time as I discovered ice climbing. Everything came together for me in that time. Before that, it was reading self-help books and going to many different psychologists and psychiatrists. It's almost like those life events, which were very, once again, they were very embodied for me. I was very physically out of control being locked up in a prison cell, or I was very physically freed ice climbing. You couldn't get two better events to happen to someone to give them an epiphany. But it was when I actually had the lived experience on my own. There were no psychologists or psychiatrists or counselors present when this happened. It was a life experience happening, and all of a sudden, all that information just clicked, and I knew that that was the turning point for my life. And no one else could have orchestrated that for me, because healing is an inside job.
Yeah.
You get the help you need and you get the support you need, but ultimately the driving force comes from within. So a healer is a facilitator to that internal driving force that everyone possesses, even if everyone may not successfully activate it through the program.
If you had to pick one thing, so we've talked a bit about some of the things that might be broken or not as functional in the healthcare system, the mental health and addiction sector. But if you had to narrow down to one or two things that you think would have the most impact for clients at the end of the day, what would you change about how we currently practice as a system?
The number one thing I would work to correct in the system is take the focus off of symptoms and move into the causes. I spent 20 years in therapy talking about and analyzing my symptoms, and little to no time looking at the causes, because the professionals didn't make the link between my symptoms and the causes. And part of that is redefining mental illness. Mental illness is a mental imbalance on the one hand, but it's also a brilliant coping mechanism for people who've lived through stresses that human beings were not designed to live through. And that could be a one-time, gigantic, traumatic event, like watching someone get shot beside you in a shootout in a grocery store. But more often than not, it's long-term, chronic stress, like I lived through as a child, and like many people live through in various manifestations in their life. So So making that connection between the stress that caused the behavioral symptoms instead of focusing on the behavioral symptoms.
I think that's wonderful advice. And that's, we talk about the unmet need at Basecamp and at other Enviros programs, in that whatever behavior, whatever action, whatever illness symptoms you say are present, they're there as solutions for an unmet need. And we all have core unmet needs around particularly belonging when it comes to a lot of our clients, this idea of connection and presence and empathy and those kinds of components that are lacking in their lives. And if we view behaviors and symptoms as the problem, we try and put band-aids on them and we try and manage them and we medicate them and we do a bunch of things. And if we look at them as solutions to an unmet need, it forces us to dig and to be curious and to not have the answers and to walk with the client to figure out what that need is and then find healthier ways to meet that need. So yeah, I think you're right on point with that piece of advice.
Now back to your point about these coping mechanisms being a brilliant way to navigate life when you have underlying stresses. I like to use the example sometimes of, if you look at me and my drug addiction, if you think about where I was at that time in my life, I'm suicidally depressed and I want to end my life because I'm in so much pain. I use the drugs to numb the pain. So if you think about it, it's actually a brilliant coping mechanism that may have saved my life, as opposed to the external societal view of, you know, oh, what a screw up, she's doing drugs, ruining her brain and ruining her life. I actually, if you were inside of me, you would actually see that I had devised a very brilliant strategy for making my pain bearable and making my life livable.
That's quite a reframe that I don't think society's ready for, to be completely honest. I think that's one of the big problems, is that the stigmatization of addiction and mental health and the repercussions that has on people and the judgment that puts on to potential clients of ours, I think is one of the biggest barriers that we actually have to work through and help people get to that point of reframing. Yeah, what would you like to dispel? That's certainly a great myth to dispel, is that addiction is in and of itself the problem as opposed to the symptom of underlying problems. Are there other myths or misconceptions that are out there around addiction and mental health that you think need to kind of be blasted?
Back to my earlier point, I would say that mental illness is simply a coping mechanism that professionals don't understand. It's not in and of itself a disease. Because when I work with these vulnerable populations, I can see the self-judgment. Now, I think having a conscience about some of your actions when you were high or drunk, I think having a conscience is one thing. Feeling remorse for things you may have done that you wouldn't do now that you've had a learning process, that's okay too. But I understand from my own experience the level of judgment when you are an addict and the level of judgment when you have a mental illness, and how little understanding there is of the story behind it. That's why I always recommend to people, anyone that I work with, I recommend writing as a therapy, because you'll be amazed at what kind of a story comes out. Mm-hmm. Is the question the myths I'd like to dispel? I think I lost the question
mind. Myths or misconceptions, things that kind of drive you nuts about how society treats or views addiction and mental health.
Well, back to your point of the way we judge and we marginalize certain demographics in our society, and drug addicts and the mentally ill are certainly one of them. It's really convenient as a society to be able to put people over in this little package and say, oh, those are the drug addicts, those are the mentally ill, when in reality, we're all the same. It goes back to that spectrum that I talked about. I think that we marginalize certain segments so that we don't have to look at ourselves, so that we don't have to see the healing that we have to do, and so that we don't have to see that we're all living in a dysfunctional society that separates us and causes, if not big trauma, it causes mini trauma in our psyche. So even the pressures that young people live through today, like the sexualization of women and young girls that are going through puberty, that's a huge stress. It might not be termed abusive behavior. It might not be termed neglect or anything like that. But you and I both know that that's a social driver that causes a lot of background stress for young people going through that change of life. And I could come up with many, many more examples of, like, we'll just use cell phones as an example. We all know the feeling when we're talking to someone and they check their cell phone, we don't feel validated. We don't feel important anymore. We feel like they're looking for something more interesting on their phone than they're finding in the conversation with us. And that person might pick up their cell phone for completely different reasons, but that's the feeling we get inside of ourselves.
Yeah, you know, one of my all-time favorite quotes, I think, was from the Hare Krishna, and it was, it's not a sign of good health to be well-adjusted in a sick society. And I always think about that anytime I see or I judge someone or I think, oh, wow, you're sick. It's like, whoa, they're in a sick society. And just because I feel like I'm well-adjusted in that society doesn't necessarily mean much.
No, and I feel you're touching on another point that I feel drug addicts and mental illness, addiction and mental illness, they put them together in social service for a reason. I believe that we, people like myself, are canaries in a coal mine, to your point of a dysfunctional society or a toxic society. Generally, we're extremely sensitive people. I have siblings, and they didn't end up suicidally depressed or drug addicted. I was the most sensitive child in the family. I was highly intelligent, and what I mean by that is very tuned into the emotional nuances going on. I guess that comes with the sensitivity. I was emotionally intelligent. I saw what was going on from a young age. My siblings did not, and I was very sensitive about what was happening and very reactive to what was happening. So what I find when I deal with these youth, I'm actually meeting some of the most sensitive, artistic, intelligent people I've ever met in my life. And that's a blessing and a curse, because it's also why the pain becomes unbearable for them and they turn to things like street drugs and alcohol. And so I believe that these canaries in the coal mine can be the most helpful people in a dysfunctional society to bring the society back into balance, because they can point to exactly where the imbalances lie. And that's another reason why marginalizing these groups is keeping society from moving forward, because they're not getting the learning from the most sensitive, emotionally intelligent segments of society.
Some great points. And I'm curious about, because you work with, obviously, you've worked with clients, you've worked with staff, you've worked with professionals across the sector. What's the response like to that message? Because this is a very different message than, like, society and the system has heard in the past. And what's been your experience around reactions to what you're saying amongst the healthcare providers at large? Maybe taking virus out of it, because I think we sing the same tune to a lot of degrees. We've worked with a lot of other organizations, and is the reaction favorable? Is it people skeptical? Like, what are you finding?
Okay, I'll speak to that in two voices. First, in the moment, and then after the fact. So, in the moment, when I'm giving a talk, or let's say I've given a talk, and a professional comes up to me afterwards and asks a question, I find the respect level for my point of view is very high. So I get anything from a, that's interesting, to a, yes, I've noticed that myself. So that's the interpersonal at the event level. The after effects, like, do I see that being incorporated into society's framework for the mentally ill or the addicted? No, not on a large scale, but it doesn't mean that I didn't plant my own seeds. Mm-hmm. To use my analogy earlier of the Enviro's staff, it doesn't mean I didn't plant my own seeds, as are other people in our society planting seeds, and it doesn't mean that it won't gain momentum, or even if it just has an effect with that one professional who's dealing with the youth. I see our mental health system as one of the bigger juggernauts in our society. And by juggernaut, I just mean a large bureaucratic institution that's set in its ways and has many vested interests. And it's very, I see a lot of opposition to a different way or to new information that they may not have been schooled in, taught in, and they may not want resources going towards that. I feel like part of my mission on Earth, if not a big part of my mission on Earth, is to help remove the stigma and to help move mental health forward. Maybe the juggernaut system will move slowly, but there's other systems that will move more quickly, like enviros, like wilderness therapy. And the beauty of today's world is that you're not beholden to a system anymore. You've got the internet, and you've got a dialogue now about mental health, so people can open up and get so many more resources than I allowed myself to when I was going through this myself.
And what are some of those favorite resources of yours? Are there any kind of books or speakers or things that, you know, obviously your own book will certainly direct people that way, but are there any resources that you would like to pass along to listeners?
I would love to. Eckhart Tolle is my best for present moment awareness. He was key during my most dangerous suicidal period, and by danger I mean actually taking action steps towards it. Finding his book, which was actually sent to me by someone, discovering his book and his work was key to helping me bring more presence, like not needing to be out climbing and not needing to be beside Karen, but actually bringing more present moment awareness into my life and accepting what he calls the pain body and acceptance as a way through to the other side. My other recommended resource is Dr. Gabor Mate, because although I discovered him after I came out the other side of my journey, he definitely got from a professional's perspective, he got the worldview that I came to on my own through my own journey, but had never heard anybody else articulate it the way Dr. Gabor Mate can articulate it. So I highly recommend his workshops and all of his books and his online videos. The other person who helped me a lot, and it's a little more fringe perhaps, is Dr. Carolyn, I don't know if she's not a doctor, Carolyn Mace. And she's a medical intuitive, and she basically wrote a book called The Anatomy of the Spirit, where she goes through the physical human body and chakra system and talks about its spiritual components and what happens when you get emotionally or spiritually unbalanced. So I really like, it's kind of a high-level take, a spiritual take, but it was really instrumental and helpful for me in understanding I'm not a freak, that people who live through these large life stresses get imbalances and then they manifest in physical, emotional, or spiritual ways.
Cool. I think that's all the questions that I've got. Is there any kind of last piece of advice or point that you want to get across to the listeners, or any actions that you'd maybe like them to take? I always like to leave people with here's your next step. Here's one thing that you can do today or tomorrow that is going to help shift your practice or shift something for you. So if you've got anything like that, would love to hear it.
First thing I'd like to say is people like the Enviro's staff, in my opinion, are doing the most important work there is on the planet, which is number one, self-healing, and number two, helping others heal. I believe the traumatized segments of our society hold the key to our society becoming more integrated and whole and healthy. And they hold the key for the reasons that I said earlier, the sensitivity, the emotional intelligence, the things that are missing from a lot of modern day institutions and corporations. As for a specific next step for the staff, just give me a second here.
Yeah.
It's coming to me, but I got to figure out a way to put it into words. I would say to anything that moves the staff, and it'll be different things for different staff members, anything that moves you more to a place of less doubt about what you're doing. And what I mean by this is, you and I have discussed how my take is different on addiction than society's take, and we know Enviro's is. I think the more Enviro's and its staff believes in itself, and the same holds true for clients, the more they believe in themselves, I believe that self-belief is the fast track for self-healing, for helping others, and also for client, for, let's just use the word success, whatever metric a person uses. When I look back on my journey and say it taking 20 years to come out of suicidal depression, and a lot of it had to do with my doubt, and it had to do with my own self-judgment around self-judgment based on society's judgment of addiction. If there's anything that I'm going to work on, this conversation has helped me, because if there's anything I'm going to work on before I interact with the youth at Shunda again, or even talk to the staff at Enviro's, is I'm going to work on how to get that message across earlier, because I know that self-doubt and self-judgment are the two biggest things that held me back in my healing journey and in my life.